Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Full of Dicks Internet Radio Program. The first podcast transmitted via the FaxCast Fax Machine Transmission Service. Have podcasts streamed directly to your fax machine. Visit us on the web at faxcast.com or dial toll-free 1-800-FAXCAST.
Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Full of Dicks Internet Radio Program. I am Mike. I'm joined, of course, by my co-host Napier.
Yo.
And via Skype, Mr. Travis Hulse.
Bonus Travis.
Bonus Travis. Twice the Travis this week. We will have two episodes this week. We are releasing an extra episode. We have the pleasure of interviewing from the band Chumbawamba, Mr. Dunstan Bruce, in just a few moments. He is promoting a documentary film about his band. You can find more information about it at igetknockeddown.com. Napier, you're excited about talking to Chumbawamba guy, right?
Yeah, I heard that song like 9 billion times throughout a two-year span of time.
And he's the guy singing it.
That song got stuck in my head so many fucking times. Like, I think it's, like, permanently burned in there.
That's one of those super popular songs that everybody had their own lyrics to. You can tell what they're saying, but most people, casually, like, I think they just kind of come up with their own lyrics until it gets to the part where you talk about pissing the night away.
And, you know, it's funny because I imagine, seeing as they are a very political group, I imagine that whatever that song is actually about has nothing to do with what we think that song is about.
Which is one of the super fascinating things to me. I had no idea in my entire life of knowing who Chumbawamba was that they were a political band.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, I've been doing a lot of Googling of the Chumbawamba because I guess A, I'm interested in conducting a decent interview, and B, it's damn interesting, guys. If you think that Chumbawamba is just the goofball song, you're wrong. There's a lot to it. That's why this documentary seems like something that... I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately, Napier. Watched the Superman Lives documentary. Well, I haven't finished it yet, but I started watching it, and it's great. And the movie that Travis told me about that... Jim Chadman later reminded me about the making of the Island of Dr. Moreau.
I just watched that this weekend.
Holy fuck, was that
amazing!
Great.
It is fucking amazing. The fact that that guy got fired off of that movie and came back as one of the fucking dog creatures, and they filmed him, and he was like 5 feet from Val Kilmer, who essentially got him fired
Napier,
from that job.
I know you don't listen to anything I say.
Yes.
But you gotta watch that documentary.
Is it on Netflix?
I know that you're freaked out by the documentary.
I'm not freaked out by documentaries.
You're a silly guy.
That Richard Stanley is a fascinating dude.
But that documentary, man, it grips you. It's what's the name of that documentary?
It's Lost Souls. I cannot remember what the subtitle.
The cursed.
That is.
We'll link it on Facebook. Give us a break. We're going on the fly here.
I watch the documentaries when HBO puts them out.
Yeah.
What is it on Netflix? Just tell me if it's on Netflix.
I don't think it is.
Well, then I can't watch it.
I stole it off the internet. I'll put it on a disc for you.
No, you won't.
I will. I'll do it right now. Well, not right now, but you know. I go to McDonald's yesterday, right? And they have an app on your telephone. You can get the McDonald's app, and they give you all kinds of good coupons. From McDonald's. So I got McDonald's on my lunch break. Got two Big Macs. Because it's buy one, get one free Big Macs.
Hot.
So I'm sitting in my car by myself, eating Big Macs. And I'm just sitting in the parking lot of my work, enjoying my lunch break by myself. I'm listening to REM. I was in an REM type mood, usually in an REM type mood. It was unusual. I'm sitting there. I'm listening to REM. I'm eating Big Macs in my car by myself. I look across the parking lot, and my fairly new boss has a brand new truck that he just bought. He just got promoted, so he went out and bought a new truck. And his girlfriend met him at work and spread out a blanket in the back of his truck, and they were enjoying a little couple's picnic in the parking lot on his lunch break.
That sounds sweet.
So
nice.
I'm sitting there, I'm eating my two Big Macs in my car, just creepily watching these guys have a picnic. And I'm thinking to myself, me and this guy live very different lives. Here I am, by myself.
No truck.
Eating two Big Macs. And this guy is having he's finding the time to have a delightful little picnic in the middle of his work day.
Why don't you do things like that?
And I got mad at him.
Why?
I'm like, fuck that guy.
What did he do other than try to live his life?
Fuck that guy and his stupid picnic. Where's my goddamn picnic?
I don't know. Maybe you should have his wife.
And it deepened because I go back to work and I'm listening to the Tiny Odd Conversations podcast. And they have this episode where the guy has a complete meltdown because he went to San Diego Comic-Con and he's walking around and seeing all the excited people. And he's wondering why he's not excited. And he kind of flips out and says, you know, that he doesn't remember ever truly feeling happy and blah, blah, blah. It's a whole thing. I'm very much paraphrasing it. It was fascinating, but his wife, who does the podcast with him, seemed to think that these aren't normal thoughts. And everything he said, I was like, yeah, dude, that's normal. And I'm listening to him. I'm like, yeah, that's how everybody thinks, right? But by the end of it, I was starting, oh, does everybody not think like that? So I was completely agreeing with the guy who somehow thinks he's crazy. And I'm thinking, oh, why do I think this is just fine? And everybody else seems to be all concerned.
Maybe he just isn't a fan of Comic-Con.
Do you?
Why wasn't that?
Well,
in his head?
Again, I'm very much paraphrasing. I encourage you to listen to the episode. You won't, but whatever. Do you feel joy?
Yes, I feel joy when I accomplish something, or you know, I'm rewarded by my wife with a sandwich or tacos.
I don't think I do really.
Well, you need to find things that you enjoy and do them. You're just not doing the things you enjoy.
You gotta think about the our existence is meaningless.
No, and you give your own meaning to your existence.
And then we go away and it was all really for nothing.
No, you impact others around you.
That's not how other people think.
No, you
don't you just kind of wake up some days and say, what am I even doing any of this for?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, not every day. That's not my life where every day I'm just sitting there wondering, what the fuck did I do? Where did everything go wrong?
I mean, we're gonna talk to this guy and, you know, he has causes and he's driven and he's trying to change the world and
Yeah, he's found something he enjoys.
And what are we doing?
Doing something that we enjoy. Hanging out, talking into microphones. With our friend who apparently...
Travis died.
Yeah, Travis died. Travis, by the way, is a white Acer netbook. I don't know if you folks out there knew that, but Travis is a white Acer netbook.
Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. That's a pretty long title.
It's a super long title. You know what's really funny about that, too, is like when, you know, back in the day, like I had nothing to do but watch movies. I just watched like every single movie that existed. I'd go to like the video store and get 2 for $1 VHS and just burn through those like crazy. And Dr. Moreau was one of those that I had taped onto one of my own. You know, I put 3 movies on a VHS.
Yeah.
I wore the fuck out of that one. It's such a terrible movie, but for some reason in like 96 or whenever the hell it was, I was fascinated by that movie because it's so off the wall. And it's amazing to see how Marlon Brando came on that movie and just sabotaged the thing. Well, he just like made all of his own decisions. Like, no, I think we'll do it like this.
I remember you actually reached out to have that guy on the show when you read something about the documentary.
Yeah, and like immediately I looked for the guys involved with that.
And he agreed to do it, but wanted to wait until the actual movie was available. And then we just kind of forgot about it. And
well, then I contacted him again, and he said, yes, let's set it up. Why don't you go ahead and email me through here? And then all of a sudden, Severin Films, it seemed like they were having some really weird inner turmoil.
Severin Films, the distributor of the movie.
Yeah, and I think he was involved with that. So I think there was just some weird things going on, and I was like, well.
But I remember when you were talking about having that guy on, I couldn't remember if I had ever even seen The Island of Dr. Moreau. I couldn't find a version of it online to steal. And so I actually went to rent it from a video rental place. And I walked around and I didn't see it anywhere. And I asked the guy, hey, do you have The Island of Dr. Moreau? And the guy said, why the hell would you want to rent that?
Is it just that bad of a movie? I've never seen it.
What kind of service you got going here? I just wanted to see this movie. What's your deal, guy? And he said, that's a really bad movie.
Well, and you can see why now. Like the guy, the Richard Stanley obviously had this weird, it's kind of like that Jodorowsky's Dune, where can you imagine if it was actually made? It would have probably been so out there.
Well, it's funny when you have somebody that has such like a crazy unique vision, like that I imagine is really just his own. I mean, like nobody else is seeing the weird shit that this wackadoodle is seeing. And so then you just like take him out, like when it's already sort of been planned and the costumes have been made and then you just put somebody else in that situation.
Yeah, in a movie where they already made costumes for like 50 dog people.
Right. And then you just say, I don't know what to tell you, guy. This kookadoodle made all these dog suits, so make a movie, I guess.
You're in the middle of nowhere in the fucking jungle. Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah, you got Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando. Spin gold.
You got what's in this trailer. Good luck. See you in 3 weeks.
So transitioning into our interview, which is coming up in just a moment, I do encourage you to check out the Kickstarter for the documentary about the band Chumbawamba. And we are going to talk to Dunstan Bruce of Chumbawamba fame in just a moment. But first...
Hi.
Hi.
So, we got this new guy at work.
Hi!
And,
Hi!
Hi!
Hello!
You got a new guy at work?
Yeah, when he started, he, like... I introduced myself to him. He looked at me funny.
Yeah.
And then he walked away. And for like a week or two, I'd catch the dude looking at me funny. And I didn't understand, like, wow, this... did I say something? Because, you know, I'm me and I say shit and that gets me in trouble sometimes.
Right.
Apparently... I am this dude's best friend's voice doppelganger, and apparently I kind of look like him, and his best friend's been dead for like 2 years.
So you took his place. You're going to be this guy's best friend now.
No, I don't want to be his best friend.
I don't think it really is up to you.
I guess no.
He's just going to follow you around and He's going to want you to be into the same things that guy was into, and you got to take his friend's place.
It seemed like it a little bit. Well, apparently, he came up to me. We're both smokers. We both go outside to do our smoking because they won't let me do my vapor in the building. So
did he at any time like say, no, that's not what Billy would have said?
Not yet.
No.
Apparently, we have the exact same mannerisms, speech pattern, and look relatively the same.
Does he show up on time to things?
Apparently not. He's dead.
Oh.
He's late forever.
He'll never be on time ever again.
I was going to say, this would be a good opportunity for us, Travis.
To just get a new one?
Just get a new one. Trade him in for a younger model.
Well, the thing that creeps him out is, the guy's dead.
Oh, yeah, that would be a bummer.
If the guy was alive, it might be, oh, that's kind of neat. Now it's like, oh, fuck, he's come back kind of thing and inhabited this chubby body.
What would be really funny is if, like, you just started telling him, like, just start hinting, like, a little bit that it might be a goof and that, like, you've been him the whole time. And
like an Andy Kaufman
thing. You were just playing a trick.
Yeah, I'm gonna go out there. I'm gonna be that dude's promoter.
Yeah,
of songs
and like every now and then, like when like he's not looking, but like when he might be able to see you out of the corner of his eye, just to freak him out, like make directions to a fake hidden camera.
Mm-hmm. Well, he started telling me the story about his friend and how he's dead and how I sound and look and act significantly like him. And the other day, he comes up to me and he goes, hey, man, like, hi, here's your old dead best friend.
Did he bring you pictures?
No. I don't know what the guy looks like. I don't know his name. But he said it would be really funny if I called the guy's widow.
Be a fun trick?
Yeah, it'd be a funny trick. Like, hey, I'm out on I-95. Want to come get me? Fuckers buried me in the woods.
I got wrapped up in some shit, but now I'm back.
Don't tell the government. I'll explain later.
Yeah, I kind of owe them all this money for 2 years of back taxes.
Oh, good times.
Just call up. You're never going to believe this shit. So I'm at this morgue, right? I had to sew my face onto a dead body like fucking John Travolta in that movie Face Off.
It's weird talking to you guys not in front of a live audience.
Well, that's just like when we do a live show.
Well, it's like weird. It's like weird doing the show not live. Like it's daytime. Like we're sitting here at a card table instead of the usual table.
Because the card table's real easy to get out.
I'm sitting in my living room with a kickstart and not like a
alcohol
beverage.
You're at home by yourself, right? The family went out of town without you?
They did. I got a couple more hours and then they're back.
Oh, Travis, have you just been enjoying yourself?
Have you taken a shit with the door open yet?
Just been hanging out, I like made chicken wings for myself on Friday and watched movies really loud.
Naked?
Underwear,
Yeah.
Dude, you should totally shit with the door open.
I do that anyway.
Yeah, Yeah, why not? You close the door when you shit?
I close the door and lock the door when I shit.
Do you really?
Yeah, it's private time. It's when I'm deucing. Not a dog. I'm not going to spin around my damn toilet. And
do you take your shirt off when you shit? I take my shirt off when I shit.
No, I got to have it all on.
Like, even when I'm in public. Like, I'll only shit in a stall that has a hook that I can hang my shirt on.
If I have,
we've had this conversation before, and I still find that wildly weird.
I'm afraid I'm gonna shit on my shirt.
How are you gonna shit on your shirt?
Kind of explosive shitting where they're gonna shit on their upper torso.
Like I'm afraid that my shirt's gonna hang down like under my butt, and I'm gonna shit on it. So, and then I'm gonna be somewhere with a shitty shirt, and I don't have a backup shirt.
So tuck it underneath your belly roll.
I've always had that fear that I've never done it. I always take my shirt off when I shit. I usually get butt-ass naked when I shit. I don't do the ankle pants. I just take them all off.
Oh, no, I can't. I have to have the ankle pants. If I don't, like, feel that on my pants, I can't shit good. Like, I will purposely, like, if I'm naked and I have to take a shit, I will purposely find something, some underwear, to go around my ankles while I shit and
see,
then
but,
take them
you're,
off.
You're a beefy fella, and, I mean, you might lose track of, like, where things are. I would think that you would understand where? My plight about the shitting on your shirt. Don't you
my
lose
shirt
track
doesn't
of...
go underneath my ass when I shit.
I hope Dunstan calls in right in the middle of this conversation.
Mike, how do you get your shirt underneath your anus?
I've always feared that was what was going to happen.
Do you sit on your shirt when you poo?
No, I take it off.
Well, whenever you had your shirt on, have you ever sat
on
your shirt?
So this is weird. This is another example of me doing things that people don't do.
No, you
just
get comfy.
I thought that was a thing that happened. I thought that people took their shirts off when they shit.
No.
Oh, no one does that.
No one does that. You do that.
And Travis, you keep the ankle pants?
Yeah. Why would I take my pants off?
Well, I mean, they're already pretty much off. How much harder is it just to put them back on? I mean, then you can kick out a wide stance and focus.
It's much harder, especially if I'm in public, because then I have to take my shoes off to get my pants off.
Oh, yeah, no, like when I'm in public, I don't take my pants off. I mean, I just do the ankle pants when I'm in public, but when I'm home in my own domain, I take everything off.
This seems like a real waste of time.
But I always take my shirt off because I don't want
to
shit on
my shirt. Do you have a ritual for everything? It sounds OCD, like you gotta be naked to shit and you gotta itch your butthole with the cream.
Before he takes his pants and shirt off, he turns the light on 14 times and then turns on the cold water.
So this is me being fucked up. That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know what you should find joy in? Really long, like, ritualized shits. Like, every time you got to poo.
No, I do. I take long shits. I generally collect my thoughts.
Oh, I got yelled at work for taking long shits.
That's a conversation. It must be really long if you're having conversations about it.
This dude,
do you take multiple shits in a day?
Not all. I try not to. Like, if I'm shitting, I hope only to shit once, but... Yeah, the manager came up to me and goes, "Hey, man, where were you?" I was like, "Taking a shit."
You know, it doesn't matter what time I wake up. I shit when I wake up.
Oh, I can't. I gotta.
If I wake up at 6 o'clock, I shit at 6 o'clock. If I wake up at 10 o'clock, I shit at 10 o'clock. I'm a morning wake up shitter.
I normally like a third into my day, I'll take a shit.
Yeah.
Like I gotta get going first. Like I gotta get the stuff moving. But apparently. Your boss can yell at you if you take 20-minute long shits at work.
So we're going to have a 20-minute conversation about shitting, and then we're going to interview someone.
Yeah, I'm going to opt out of the rest of this shit conversation.
I mean, that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about shitting for 20 minutes, then we're going to interview a musician for 20 minutes. And then what? What's the closing act of this show, Napier?
We already talked about...
We already had a conversation.
Yeah, we had a conversation afterwards.
This is crazy.
This sounds like a regular episode.
The thing about it is you always want the guests to promote the episode. And, you know, then they listen to it and they're like, I don't know if I can get behind letting people know that I was on this show where they talked about shitting for 20 minutes.
You know, I thought the
Todd Glass was fine with it.
He didn't promote it.
Fair enough.
I thought for sure that Beelzebub would promote it, and he didn't promote shit.
I only mentioned him in one, but he didn't. Yeah, he didn't do anything.
I think he said that he doesn't actually tweet. I think that his tweets are just from his Facebook.
Oh.
I think he said he just has a Twitter account so he isn't impersonated. But still, I checked his Facebook and he didn't put anything. I sent him the link in an email and he didn't send anything out about it.
Is it weird that people do that now? Like, you have to have a Facebook, you have to have an Instagram, you have to have Twitter, just so that somebody else doesn't call them you.
I want to know who's going, man, I gotta pretend I'm Beelzebub. I mean, who would do that?
How many fake Bill Cosbys are there out there where somebody grabs a Bill Cosby name and starts talking about roofies and Jell-O?
But you know what? The funny thing is, it works. I saw a tweet the other day from a fake Ed Sheeran. And I mean, like, you could tell immediately, this is a fake Ed Sheeran. I mean, like, his Twitter handle was like, it's Ed Sheeran boy or something. And we were like, it's obviously not Ed Sheeran, but you put a picture of Ed Sheeran on there and you make the name Ed Sheeran and nobody looks at the at mention and they just say, oh, Ed Sheeran is tweeting about, you know, this. And it was incredible because, I mean, like, it had like 100 retweets.
There are many fake Bill Murray Twitter accounts because he's not on Twitter. And I think there's just some that are just flat out Bill Murray with a picture of Bill Murray acting like they're Bill Murray.
And people are like, oh, look at this thing that Bill Murray said.
Yeah, look at Bill. Let me retweet Bill Murray's quote of the day.
My favorite is the customer service representative. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I've seen that.
That is great. That is the funniest goddamn thing on Twitter.
Travis, should we make an impersonating Napier account and just say that Napier's on Twitter now?
Sure.
Well, I am on Twitter.
Maybe we should make like a celebrity that only retweets links to the Wheelbarrow Full of Dicks internet radio program. Like,
there you go.
What if we just like make like another Dave Chappelle account and just be like, yo, my boys at the Wheelbarrow Full of Dicks have a new episode out.
Is Jennifer Lawrence on Twitter?
Yeah, she's gotta be.
Yeah, like just get like a really attractive picture of Jennifer Lawrence and just say, make like the account, yeah, you know, it's your girl J-Law.
No, you gotta do something wacky. Make it Martha Stewart. Martha Stewart's just retweeting dicks all day.
It's your girl, J-Law. And then every Monday, it'll be like, hey, my favorite podcast is on live tonight. And then see if that works.
And then tweet like a quote from the Hunger Games.
Retweet a bunch of Hunger Games tweets. And then get... we're doing that. I'm doing that as soon as we get off here.
And then nothing but WFOD links. Come see my new movie with Bradley Cooper. But before you do, listen to the latest episode of WFO Dicks.
This is going to work. This is going to be our big marketing coup.
This is our big break. A fake Twitter account.
You know what works really good in a post-apocalyptic wasteland? A big old wheelbarrow covered in dicks.
Travis, the Conrad and Jack show, which I've never actually listened to before, but we used to interact with them on Twitter when they were on Radio FUBAR and we were on Radio FUBAR.
Right.
They have a Twitter account that, like, the bio is, I'm a really big fan of the Conrad and Jack show. And, like, they just follow everybody. And this account only retweets stuff from the Conrad and Jack show. And it's, I mean, like, everything they tweet, this account retweets it. And I think it's just either Conrad or Jack that made a fake fan of their show that only retweets links to their show.
Just trying to get people psyched up to see that they have, like, an Uber fan.
Yeah, and, I mean, this account has, like, followed me and unfollowed me, like, 6 times. And, I mean, you know, I follow the Conrad and Jack show. I don't need to follow the account of the thing that retweets the Conrad and Jack show.
No.
Would it be funny to do that to another podcast?
Make, like, their fake fan?
Make their fake fan and just retweet
No, you'll get it. Tweets. You'll get it.
It takes it a minute. Just do that over and over again, and everybody's thinking, like, oh, well, these are some vain fucks. Already, that sounds like a great idea, just to fuck with people. make a shit ton of fake fan accounts for some podcast that you don't like, and all you do on those things is retweet everything that they say, just to make it look like, oh, well, these people are fudging their numbers, aren't they?
Is the Conrad and Jack one, is it just Conrad and Jack fan?
I don't know. It's a picture of a clown.
Larry Sparkles loves the Conrad and Jack show.
Yeah, it's a picture of a clown that loves the Conrad and Jack show.
You know what's super funny about that is there are a shit ton of those for, like, when O&A was still a thing, and they'd be like, yeah, world's number one O&A fan, baby! And then all that account did was, like, interact with Opie and or Anthony, and then just retweet all of their garbage.
So that's probably why some people start Twitter accounts. Like, they want to interact with something that they're a fan of.
Right.
And so they just make an account so that, like, you know, when Opie and Anthony goes live and they ask for Twitter questions or something, they have that ability to do it because that's how you do it. But other than that, they don't actually have anything to say.
Well, apparently you can buy those. You can buy those type of accounts, and you pay a service X amount of dollars, and they create a shit ton of fake accounts. And they only follow your show, and they retweet shit tons of your stuff. And apparently people were getting in trouble for that because it looks like, oh, they're fudging your numbers or
what do you get from it?
It
looks like you have
popular.
A bunch of interactions, so then people are like, oh, look at how much they interact.
Like, I mean, like radio guys that, you know, pretend like they have 625,000 Twitter followers. I mean, like, then what? Do you get guests based on that? Like, guests see you have a big following, and
that's why people do anything. You look at them like, oh, these people have, you know, a shit ton
of
episodes.
So you're faking it until you – and tricking people into thinking you actually have success to then build to actually have success?
Right.
Exactly.
You're going to get offered jobs – you know, especially in, like, media, depending on how many people already follow you. So if you're a small market radio guy and it looks like you have, you know, 785,000 followers, you're much more likely to be hired in a larger market area
because
or something
people,
syndicated.
But, I mean, I would imagine that anyone could do any sort of research and go down somebody's timeline and see they have no interactions, they have nothing going on other than this fake number. I mean, like,
yeah, but you'd have to actually put some time and effort into that, or you could just look at how many Twitter followers they have. I can't talk today.
Yeah, and that I guess that would tie into something that we're going to talk to, you know, Dunstan about, is like, you know, when you hit a certain level, you may alienate some of, like, your actual fans for, like, more fans, but not necessarily the right ones. Does that make sense?
Money spends the same to
me.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
I wouldn't give
a
shit.
A fan is a fan.
Right.
You know, anytime you can get anybody engaged in anything that you're putting out there to be consumed, I mean, that's great, whether they're hardcore fans that come to every show and, you know, or the guys that are just buying your albums and shit online. You know, who cares?
Right.
I mean, when you live the life of an entertainer, you want more people to hear you. You want people to like your stuff. You don't want to put shit out there that's crappy and nobody wants to listen to. You do it because, you know, you actually want your voice out there. And these people, they got it. I mean, they got their voice out there. It happened once, and they did a shit ton of stuff with it. So, the Chumbawamba people.
So let's get into the interview.
Excellent. Let's do this. We're going to be awesome, and I'm not going to say a word.
This is Shadwick from Quiet Hollers, and you're listening to Strangelabel.com, or at least it is playing in the background of whatever it is that you're doing right now.
Our guest tonight is Dunstan Bruce, formerly of the band Chumbawamba,
who is promoting his documentary film currently being kickstarted. To learn more, go to igetknockeddown.com. Dunstan, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Obviously, I want to do it because I want to tell the world about me film and my Kickstarter campaign.
Right, and you're close. You guys, you're in the home stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's gone really, really well.
You're getting a lot of publicity from it. And you know what? It's funny because I think that the majority of people probably just know you guys from that one song. You guys, you know, you were the goofballs that had the drunk song. Yeah. And it caught me by surprise when I watched that Kickstarter video because I was like, I didn't know any of this stuff. And here I am, you know, what has it been? 20 years since that song?
18?
Yeah, 18, and yeah. Here I am Googling Chumbawamba and reading about you guys, and I was fascinated. Now, I want to see this movie, so there's a stake in it now for me, too, because I want to see it get made.
Good.
So I'm familiar with it, but I assume our listeners aren't. What is the film basically about? You are formerly a member of the band Chumbawamba.
I was in the band for 23 years. I left in 2005, along with Alice, Dambert, and Harry. We all left at the same time. Basically, the idea of the film is that a lot of people just know that one song, Tub Thumping, the I Get Knocked Down song. And I want to sort of tell the story of the band and what happened in the fact that we'd existed for 15 years prior to that and how we got to that point. And how, in my eyes, we had this accidental hit. And what, as a political band, what we did when we entered the mainstream and whether what we did, we achieve anything? Did we use that time well? Did we have an impact? Can pop and politics combine? And can you do something useful with that? So it's all those sort of things. At the same time, looking at different people's versions of what happened within the band as well, because we all had a different experience of it as well.
I saw you guys received money from licensing the song to GMC.
Yeah.
And then you used the money to finance some sort of anti-GMC advocacy group?
Exactly that, yeah. Yeah. That was Court Watch. That was an organization called Court Watch. And the idea of that was that we were getting so many requests for people to use Chumbawamba songs. And there was a lot of stuff that we turned down. But at the same time, there was a lot of stuff we accepted and then decided that we would do something smart and subversive with the money that we got from the use of the song. And General Motors was a classic example of that they wanted to use a song of ours. It wasn't even Tub Thumping that they wanted to use. It was another song. And we just thought, oh, well, let's use that money. Let's say yes and let's use that money for something that we believed in, rather than just accepting the advert and that being it. I think once we got into that situation where we were in a powerful situation, we had a platform. It was important that we use that to sort of let the rest of the world know what we what our political stance was on a lot of things.
And it's funny because, you know, when I read that, my initial reaction, well, God, did they even bother to Google them and see what they're about? But I guess this was probably nearing the time where it was the last couple of years that you could even get away with that. I guess Google wasn't as, but then again, do you think that they would even would they even care?
Well, when they were told about it, when General Motors were told about what we'd done, they just sort of released a statement that said something like, we weren't particularly aware of their political background, and we didn't know that this was their intention and stuff like that. So they had no idea what we were up to, really. They just knew the band because of that one song. And so that was like a sort of Trojan horse situation, really, where we'd sort of somehow found ourselves in the mainstream, and a lot of people didn't really know anything about us. So it was a really great position to be in, because you could do all this subversive stuff that people were not expecting.
Was it a happy accident? Did you go into, you know, producing that album and that song to try to get into the mainstream? Like you said, you've been around for 15 years. Was it just like the right time for one of your songs to hit? I always find it really fascinating that a band can be around that long and then all of a sudden have this one song that everybody knows. And when you look at their back catalog, you're like, wow, this band's been around a long time. This is not what I expected to hear from them.
You know, that question is pretty much at the nub of the film, really. It's like, was it an accident, or was it something that we were getting closer and closer to? I regard it as an accident myself. And I just think it was the right time, a song that had a universal anthemic feeling about it, that people didn't realize that we had this, you know, this anarcho-punk history. And it was just that the song chimed with a lot of people. We never set out to write a hit single. You know, it was just, and in fact, prior to that album, the band itself was in a bit of a state of disarray, to be honest. And so that album was something that galvanized us again, brought us back together as a band, and focused, you know, gave us a lot of focus. Because prior to that, the album before that we did, I think it was the worst album we ever did.
Huh.
And I think we were in a bit of a state of disrepair, and we needed something like that to bring us all together. And that song sort of epitomized that, really.
So it was a kind of a double-edged sword, though. I mean, like you said, that it brought you all back together, and obviously it made you guys some money to be able to go after, you know, to use it towards your causes. But did it also kind of steal your identity as a band and turn you into something that you weren't?
In a way, yes. In a way, yes, it did. I mean, we lost a lot of loyal followers over what we did with that, because a lot of people didn't think we should have done it. We'd always sort of done exactly what we wanted, in a way, but although we were aware that we were part of a community, and we just hoped that community would understand what we were trying to do and what we were trying to achieve with the decisions we made about, once we realized that song was going to be a hit, it would seem a waste of an opportunity, to enter the mainstream, because, nobody does. I mean, it's very rare that anybody does get into that position and then do something really interesting with it. We wanted to take that opportunity to do that.
Well, I feel like that's a very noble thing, too, because a lot of people, once they would get that one mainstream hit that would, you know, have everybody recognize the band, would maybe kind of, you know, abandon their ideology and just be like, hey, look at all this money that we have now.
Guys, we can get jet skis now.
Right.
it's funny that, because I think as people, I think we were sort of political before we were pop stars. And so we couldn't just betray our past and what we thought and how we felt about stuff. And being in a band with so many people, you know, everybody was always checking, you know, everybody was, looking after each other or keeping an eye on each other or, you know, and we'd always present this united front. And we'd spend a lot of time in meetings discussing what we wanted to do. It was a very organized, for what people's perception of anarchy is, we were a very, very organized outfit, very organized. And, you know, and it was almost like, the antithesis of what anybody would regard anarchy as.
Well, I find that very interesting then, that you said that you lost some of the loyal followers that you had throughout the years, when obviously if they were still following what you were doing, they could see that you weren't giving in to the machine and you were still following, you know, like I said, your ideology and the money that you were making was going towards the thing that you were doing. But I suppose it has a lot to do with, you know, that old feeling of, you know, once a band or once something becomes mainstream, you know, certain groups of people don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. We suffered from that massively. Yeah. And I understand that, because I've done that myself with bands. You know, I've done that exactly that, you know, like, oh, a band's gone mainstream. I'm not interested anymore. I always preferred their earlier stuff. I mean, we still get that, you know, we still get that now, even now. I preferred your earlier stuff, your first two albums. And that's great. You know, I'm really proud of everything that we've done, really. Well, 95% of what we've done, I'm really proud of. But that was the price we paid. You know, that was the price we paid for trying to get out of a scene, or trying to get out of a ghetto, or trying to get out of a something that felt like it was inward looking as opposed to outward looking. And I think we just wanted to reach as many people as possible, without losing our integrity. You know, we always try to maintain our integrity. That wasn't necessarily easy all the time, because we did find ourselves in some bizarre situations, and occasionally the song would get used for something really ridiculous.
I think you made reference to
it was something
to like
that you couldn't really control, and that was part of the issue as well with how people responded to it in band, was that it did feel as though there was a lot of it that we lost control over, and up until that point we'd always controlled everything so carefully. So it was a struggle at times to maintain control over everything as well.
Going back to the selling out thing and losing your dedicated fans from before you had it, what do you think that is? Because that's really, shouldn't you be happy for something that you like hitting some kind of stride and becoming popular and other people discover it? I mean, you can always still say, hey, I heard it first, and yeah, the music that you loved before still exists. So I mean, I think I'm guilty of it too, but I don't understand why we do it.
It's selfishness, I believe. You know, this is mine.
Is it like a sense of ownership? Is it like, you know, this band was mine and very few other people knew about it, and now it's everyone's, and I don't like sharing.
Yeah, I think some of that. I think there's some of that. I think there's some of the exclusivity of it and you know, finding something that means something to you, and then suddenly that meaning can be diluted or lost when something goes mainstream, and you think, and it's, I suppose there's an element of snobbery maybe attached to it as well. But at the same time, it's, from our perspective, it was something that we would always strive to achieve, was to play our music to people who listened to chart music, and who maybe didn't have a political bone in their body to then discover Chumbawamba. And as I say, that song was like a Trojan horse, really, because, you know, that song was by no means Chumbawamba's best song. It was by no means Chumbawamba's most political song. It was just a song that chimed with people and that people recognized had, you know, hit potential written all over it. And, I mean, I'm still proud of that song, but I don't necessarily think it's the best song we've ever done. And it was just a song that we could use to go on David Letterman, for instance, and change the words of the chorus. So we were singing about Free Mumia Abu Jamal. Now, we would have never been there, but we would have never got any sort of national coverage for the plight of Mumia Abu Jamal had we not had a hit record.
Right.
So, you know, that was the sacrifice we were certainly prepared to make.
I think it's the goal of every artist too, right? To get as many people as possible to see or to hear your art.
Yeah, completely. You know, when we got into bed with Satan or whatever we did, you know, like we were determined we were going to enjoy ourselves as well. It wasn't like, you know, I'm not trying to make out that we were worthy, you know, worthy political activists. We, you know, there was an element of it where we just thought, this is taking a leap in the dark. Let's just have a fantastic time. If it doesn't work out, we can go back to putting out records in a year's time, and, you know, we will have just had this amazing experience. And in a way, you know, a couple of years later, we released an album that completely bombed, and we did go back to what we'd been doing before.
One is all it took to go back, huh?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it was very quick. But, you know, part of that was because that, again, that's part of the film, is like some people in the band hated the attention, hated the sort of being the pressure, hated how you know, how they were never with their families. So there was a lot of reasons why it came to an end. You know, it came to an end. We were as much to blame for that as the record buying public, as far as I'm concerned.
So why do you think now is the time to make this movie? Like, what prompted you to decide to tell the story?
I tell you what happened is that Chumbawamba actually came to an end in 2012. And I didn't feel as though I could make this film before the band had actually stopped playing. Because I think in a way I would have been standing on their toes, or it would have been interfering what they were trying to still do as a band. And I think that would have been unfair on them as a band and as individuals. So I think it was only when the band stopped that I thought, right, now is the time I can go and make this film. And to be honest, it's taken me that long to get to this stage where I found the right people to work with and we're raising the money to get the film made. Because for a few years, I've been doing a talk about this very thing, about entering the belly of the beast. And it was thinking about that and thinking that that could become a film. I had that idea a few years ago. It's just taken a long time to get to the point where it looks like the film will actually get made.
Plus, now we're in the time when you can actually take it to your fans, casual fans or longtime fans, and actually have them help you finance the movie and bring awareness to it too, I suppose, help.
Do you know what? Doing the Kickstarter campaign has been, I know that was the one, I know retrospectively that was the right way to go about it because it has engaged so many people in the idea of Chumbawamba again. It's been amazing. The response has been amazing. Not only has the Kickstarter campaign been amazing and the fact that so many people have contributed, it's just the fact that it's the amount of emails and messages we've had, you know, from people with stories or anecdotes or memories about the band and what the band meant to them back in the 80s or the 90s has been incredible. It's been absolutely incredible. And it's just made me think, this is brilliant. This feels like what it used to feel like back in the 80s, back in the 90s. It feels like there's a group of people who really want this film to be made and are still loyal to the band and what the band stood for. So it's been a great experience. Even now, if it didn't make the money, if the campaign just stopped yet tomorrow, you know, I'd feel completely invigorated by the whole experience so far and would make sure that the film got made.
So what is the website if a listener wants to check out the project?
There's a website called igetknockdown.com. And there's also a part of the Kickstarter campaign, which is if you go to Kickstarter and put in Dunstan Bruce or I Get Knocked Down, you'll find the project on Kickstarter.
igetknockdown.com or go to the Kickstarter campaign, search for Dunstan Bruce. Dustin, yeah, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
We look forward to seeing the film. And, thanks a lot.
Yeah, keep in touch. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about
it. Oh, absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck, okay. Dustin. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, man. Thank you.
Wouldn't it be funny if the movie makes them big again and the whole cycle starts over?
I think that would be fascinating because then they could go in another like 15 or so years and make another movie about
shit. Like the things that like I was reading about that they did, you know, all these licensing deals that they would get and then they would funnel that money to advocacy groups and things like that. Like you can't do that now.
Well, it's amazing to me too. Like you have a lot of bands that they completely change their sound on purpose to try to get mainstream.
Right.
They actually do hit mainstream, and they really do abandon the identity, where they actually took that success and funneled it directly back into things they were already passionate about, which you just do not see people doing anymore.
Right.
They take that money and they run.
It's funny because, like, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. That song, I hate that song.
I'll tell you, it's just like any other thing where it hit. I loved that song when it came out, and it was just so in your face.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of those inevitable things that, like, you're going to hear that song when you go to a hockey game, or you're going to hear that song when you're in a bar for any amount of time.
Oh, they play it. They still play it at that the kind of, you know, AAA Woodbat League baseball games that I go to randomly here in the summer in my little town. They just play snippets of it between like innings, you know.
Right, and God, you know, I kind of wish that I still had him on. I was gonna ask him, like, you know, if he still gets paid from that song. I mean, like,
they still do.
They have to make something out of it, but you know, they hit it big in the time when, you know, record companies were making really scammy deals to where, you know, they might have only got royalties up into a certain point, or, you know, I mean, there were a lot of artists making a lot of money, but also really getting screwed on the back end.
But I find it just so interesting that, like, you know, and what he acknowledged in the Kickstarter video, and it's absolutely true. Most people just know that they made that song, and they either like or hate that song, and they assume this is what this band is about. They're the guys that made the stupid drunky song. And like when I saw this video and I'm reading about Chumbawamba, I'm like, these guys are kind of far out. This is kind of cool. And I'm now fascinated years and years later by a band that, you know, at the time they were popular, I just kind of wrote off as goofballs.
Well, that is the most interesting thing to me.
The song was popular, and in turn, they benefited from it greatly.
Well, yeah, they were everywhere. Like you said,
I don't think that there was anybody in the band that was like famous, like thing. But
well, that's because they didn't abandon their identity. You look at a band that came out at the exact same time that kind of, you know, hit it big with one song, Sugar Ray. They had that fucking Fly song that
Sugar Ray.
And but if you looked back into their catalog, that was not what that band
was. they were hardcore.
Yeah, and they decided instead of, you know, keeping their identity like Chumbawamba obviously did and followed their ideology, like they went the complete opposite way, and every single song that they wrote was then some kind of a deviation off of
it
Fly.
It was sort of Fly.
And now
Fly
Mark McGrath hosts like the singing bee and shit.
they pulled a Liam Neeson.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I have a hit. I'll just keep making that hit over and over again.
And maybe we'll get one that works.
And that was at a time where you had to buy like a whole fucking album to get that one song you wanted.
Yeah.
That was like right before all that shit started coming out.
I bought that CD. I did.
Of course,
it was the CD with Fly on it. Fly came out. I was like, fuck yeah, Fly. And you know what? I liked the rest of the CD, but there was not another Fly or anything close to it on that CD. That CD was all yelly, screamy, hardcore shit.
It was like
the last song was Fly.
Yeah. And then
it was like tacked on at the end. It was like, oh yeah, by the way.
Every album that they put out after that sounded exactly like Fly. Every single song was them trying to recapture that moment. And they did a few times.
Do you think the Chumbawamba guys, you know, they had all these people buying their music that probably didn't agree with them politically? Like, ha, gotcha, fuckers. Listen to 13 tracks of this.
And that was before iTunes, when you could like just buy one song.
You could buy CD singles, though. There'd be like two songs on them for like a super disc.
Right.
Yeah.
But
singles still existed.
But they were still like $3 or $4 and the CD's 10. So I imagine most people probably just went ahead and bought the CD. I used to get burned by that all the time. One song I liked and then, you know, 10 I thought were kind of stupid.
Yeah, I had that same reaction.
But yeah, in America, they sold millions and millions of albums because people wanted that one song.
So somewhere floating around, there's a whole shit ton of Chumbawamba CDs.
Like, yeah, probably like in garage sales and bargain bins and stuff. Because, I mean, really nowadays, even if you still wanted that song, you just rip it onto your computer and then get rid of the CD. Well, guys, that's the show. Thanks again to Dunstan Bruce. Hey, if you enjoyed the Dunstan Bruce interview, why don't you send him a little tweety guy at Dunstan Bruce and let him know you heard him here and that it was good. That would be great. Guys, let's do that. And our live show from Monday will be available later on in the week. We appreciate anyone who listened. We'll see you back live Monday night on strangelabel.com. Bye. My mother says she wished she never had me. Had me. Had me. Would you like to have me as a friend? Would you like to have me as a friend? I'm a recovering alcoholic, I rarely leave my room. Peeping through the curtains in my dog costume. The voices in my head, oh, they'll get me in the end. Would you like to add me as a friend? I'd really like to mail you the picture that I drew. It's Kylie's body, but the head is you. I've asked you 50 times before, I'm asking you again. Would you like to add me as a friend? At me, at me. Me mother says she wish she never had me. At me, at me. Would you like to have me as a friend? Would you like to have me as a friend? I want you to know it's over. Well, bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can hear us live every Monday night at 9, 8 Central on strangelabel.com. You can download all of our past episodes as well as other goodies at WFODix.com. Pull up our show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the TuneIn app. You can follow us on Twitter at WFODix. You can also follow Travis at ProduceTravis or Drunk at DrunkardSTL. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/WFODix. You can email us at WFODshow@gmail.com. Or you can give us a call when we're live or leave us a message that we may play later on. That phone number is 636-487-4263. Again, thank you for listening. We will see you back here next week.